Bibi Fahodie, welcome to the African Liberation Media Podcast. Media solely focused on the liberation and empowerment of African people. I'm your host, Gullah Jack, a.k.a. Russell Swilly. Let's get to it. Bibi Fahodie, today's date is November 22nd, the murder of Tamir Rice occurred on this particular day. Young man taken out of his development. 56 years ago, Malcolm X was killed February 21st, 1965. New information has come out, chronicled in a book called The Ray Woods Story. Interestingly, the security team of Malcolm X was arrested days before his assassination at the Audubon Ballroom. Malcolm told us, and you can pick this up by way of many of the documentaries, that have been preserved, that the police knew of the attempts to assassinate him because the NOI had been thoroughly infiltrated. However, there has been additional nefarious efforts that have come out, documented and chronicled on various information sources. Democracy Now, involving a gentleman by the name of Ray Wood and Bossy, who were working for the state. This is African Liberation Media. I have with us brothers Amos and Makaru. Gentlemen, take it wherever you want to take it.
Yeah, Bibi Fahodie, African family. Once again, we appreciate having the opportunity to deliver some information, you know, from our perspective, that is African-centered critical thinking. And several events of historical significance are currently taking place or have currently taken place within the last few weeks, few days. The most important of these, in my opinion, is the trial of the three men who murdered Ahmaud Arbery on February 23rd, 2020. That is the trial of Gregory McMichaels, his son Travis, and William Roddy Bryan. You know, they face a series of counts, about nine criminal counts, including a malice murder, felony murder, two aggravated assault charges, one involving their pickup trucks, the other involving the shotgun. And I listened to as much of the trial as I could. I was very surprised when the defense lawyer representing Travis McMichael decided to put him on the witness stand. I thought that was a very risky move. And I figured that any prosecutor worth his or her weight would just rip him to shreds. And, you know, that didn't happen. Linda Donikowski, who is the senior assistant district attorney for Cobb County, Georgia, is the lead prosecutor in this case. And she did a credible job in terms of destroying the two reasons that the killers gave. One, that they were attempting to make a citizen's arrest, which they never announced. And two, that they were acting in self-defense. I thought she did a good job of attacking those two particular you know, claims of innocence or reasons for, you know, being not guilty. Particularly the citizen's arrest, which the citizen's arrest law, which was enacted, interestingly enough, right after the Civil War period, or perhaps maybe just a little bit before the Civil War period in Georgia, allows a citizen to make an arrest if they see a person committing a serious crime. Now, these people did not see Ahmaud Arbery committing any crime. She was able to get McMichael to admit that Ahmaud Arbery was not armed. But he had the audacity to say, and this is the language that generally gets these vigilantes and police officers, law enforcement officers off, you know, it gets them exonerated. And that is, he said he feared for his life. Now, Travis McMichael was riding in a pickup truck armed with a shotgun. His father was standing in the bed of the pickup truck armed with a .357 Magnum. And William Roddy Bryant had already bumped into Ahmaud Arbery on at least one, perhaps two occasions. So a vehicle, as we saw with the horrendous incident in Wisconsin where this guy plowed into a crowd of people, killing six, wounding over 40, a vehicle is indeed a weapon. And vehicles have been used constantly as weapons, you know, since the incident in Charlottesville that resulted in the death of one of the people who are protesting against the white nationalists in Charlottesville. And that's why they have an aggravated assault charge regarding their trucks. But he had the audacity to say that he feared for his life. And, you know, that's, you know, what is, you know, so you have a black man who is unarmed, you know, he doesn't have a fingernail file in his possession, and he is being pursued by two people who are armed and, you know, three trucks. The interesting thing about her letting, him off the hook on that particular point was that on February 11th, Travis McMichael allegedly saw Ahmaud Arbery in the home of Larry English, which was under construction. It was a home in the neighborhood that Ahmaud Arbery ran through quite often in Sotillo Shores, which is part of Glynn County, Georgia. And Ahmaud would walk into the home periodically. I've done the same thing because sometimes you're like, oh, wow, you know, how's this floor plan? Maybe he was dreaming about his own home, or maybe he was planning, you know, a home, or, you know, this is what I would like a home to look at. But the interesting thing is that many people were seen on the video camera, including a white couple who was seen with a duffel bag, and items were disappearing. Ahmaud Arbery never had anything in his possession other than his hands, which were empty. What could he do? Put some nails in his pocket, or, you know, some tacks and screws or what? I mean, so, but anyway, on February the 11th at 7:30 at night, this is 7:30 on the East Coast, 7:30, it's dark in February at, you know, right after 5:30. So he approached Ahmaud Arbery, didn't say anything about being armed. Ahmaud was apparently walking through the property or on the property. And he claimed that Ahmaud Arbery reached for his waistband. That's the other key word that you always hear. That's the other trigger word. One, I feared for my life. Two, black man reaches for his waistband, meaning he's reaching for a gun. Tamir Rice reached for his waistband. What was he reaching for? A toy gun? I mean, it's absurd, right? I mean, he was killed in less than 2 seconds. So what? It's incredible. But McMichael never said anything about fearing for his life at 7:30 at night, apparently unarmed. And the prosecutor didn't challenge him on that point. I thought she missed an opportunity there. But given the weight of the evidence, particularly the claim of self-defense, where Travis McMichael had moved ahead of Ahmaud and stopped his truck. Roddy Bryan was behind Ahmaud. So basically he was between the two trucks. McMichael could have easily stayed in his truck, but he got out with his shotgun. And we can only assume that in an act of desperation to save his life, Ahmaud Arbery may have reached for the gun to try to save his life. And was shot 3 times, twice in the chest, and once in the a bullet. Some of the buckshots went through his wrist, and blood started spurting from his radial artery. So he fell in a puddle of his own blood that was already forming, and died, you know, on the spot. I listened to some of the first police officers on the scene testify. And it sort of reminded me of pictures I've seen from a lynch mob. While the police officers were talking to the McMichaels and Brian, people in the community were mingling among them, walking among them, asking them if they were okay, talking to them, asking them what happened. And there's a black man laying on the street dead. I mean, this is the mentality. And of course, we know that the district attorney, the former district attorney in Glenn County, Jackie Johnson, has been indicted by a grand jury, indicted, arrested, released on $10,000 bond. That happened in September. Because she instructed the police officers not to arrest Travis McMichael. And, you know, she's been indicted by a grand jury on several charges, you know, for those activities. This just shows the mentality, the white supremacist mentality of the area that, you know, Ahmaud Arbery just was out on a Sunday afternoon jog. And then was pursued and chased, as you know, as if he was escaping chattel slavery, and killed. In a just society, these guys would be convicted. In some society, in some states today, if people of African descent had done this, they certainly would be given the death penalty. But this is the United States. The trial is taking place in Southern Georgia. There are 11 whites and one person of African descent. The odds are greater that you will get a hung jury than they are that you will get a conviction. But it's a possibility that justice could roll down like waters. You know, we'll just have to see. So, you know, those are just some initial thoughts. I didn't have much time today to listen to the closing arguments, but I do know that the lead prosecutor definitely brought up the issue of race. And she said point blank that the reason why this man was pursued was because he was a black man. Because they didn't challenge any of the other people who had been on the property. They didn't pursue any of the other people who had been on the property. Apparently all of them were white. and there were some items stolen out of from the property, but they didn't pursue it. They didn't suspect anybody else. They suspected a black man running down the street with his hands empty of being the person who was doing these imaginary break-ins. So, this is the case, in my opinion, that is the most important of those that are taking place. Rittenhouse, as expected, was found not guilty. That's no one is surprised, by that decision, particularly, given the hanging judge that presided over the case, and the Charlottesville, the white supremacists who were on trial in Charlottesville, that's a civil case. And the jury is deliberating the outcome of that now. So, but this is the case, in my opinion, that's the most important. And it will be followed in January by the Tatiana Jefferson trial, the cop that killed Tatiana Jefferson in Texas. So, we're in this time frame now where the pot is boiling. The pot is definitely boiling, and we just need to be totally aware of everything that's going on around us.
Quick point, piece of information that's almost too unfathomable to digest. Maurice Freeland, aka the Junk Kick Man, who kicked Kyle Rittenhouse, has been charged with assault and battery. So that's something that
now this was the black guy that jumped over him. I thought he missed.
Apparently he made contact.
Okay.
And he has been charged. This has come to my attention as recently as, say, an hour ago with assault and battery. Good possibility that he may be convicted and go to jail.
Well, no surprise.
No, it's not. The question is, what will be our response? At every level, we are not taken seriously at all. Are we at a point that Dr. Wilson talks about? He articulated way back in the 90s that the European never intends to release control over us. And when he does, the intent is to kill us.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate assessment by Bob Amos Wilson. You can see it across the board. I mean, everything that has happened ever since we've been, quote unquote, free from chattel slavery, it's been that sense of control by the European over us. And the only other thing that has happened outside of them controlling us has been them murdering us. So I think that that's a very valid point, Color Jack.
Yes, sir.
As far as the Rittenhouse case was concerned, it was hard for me to really pay attention to the case because I didn't have any skin in the game, I guess, if you could say that, or any dog in the fight. This is a case between the Anglo-Saxons and the Ashkenazi. And in regards to the verdict that came down, I expected him to get off on the charges for him, killing the Jewish guy based on, the self-defense aspect. What was more surprising to me was them ignoring the the fact that he was an underage person and him owning a rifle,
right,
which was, according to the law, illegal. Again, you know, like I said, I don't really have any emotional attachment to it either way, but if you're following the law, then he should have been found guilty for that, just based off of the evidence with him owning the gun and him being 17 and underage. In regards to the Ahmaud Arbery case, I don't know which way this is going to go, but I think that if there is a not guilty verdict, then you will probably see a lot of unrest and a lot of violence in the streets take place.
Definitely. Definitely.
The concern that is being discussed, and you gentlemen have heard this, deals with the implication of extra legal violence, fascist violence, as McCarroll wrote about it, being meted out against legitimate protesters. Interesting term that is circulating, part of the nomenclature, adjacent blacks. You know, we can contrast that with a person like O.J. Simpson, which is the racist go-to. Well, what do you think about O.J.? Well, then the flip side of that would be O.J. would be an adjacent white person. You know, we could classify and, you know, conduct a discussion as to who constitutes an adjacent black person. Obviously, that would be people like Marilyn Buck, Thaddeus Stevens, Charles Sumner, the names that we've seen on African Liberation Media, Viola Lausa, Schwerna, Goodman, and Cheney, and others, the brother who bought a house for an African-American couple that was denied a mortgage. You know, periodically, you know, we'll find these whites who have illuminated views and work in the interest, it seems, for Africans throughout the diaspora. Generally, though, we are mindful of the fact that when whites are oppressed, you know, typically what they do is side with whiteness. We're talking about power and privilege. But there have been periodic pieces of illumination, you know, where, you know, whites have acted in the best interest of blacks. This thing with race can be very complicated in some instances. I have seen brothers who were property owners and contracted white laborers who donned a rebel flag on their front porch. Yeah, and the wife of the laborer attacked another white woman for speaking derogatorily about the contract. Obviously, you know, her vested interest was involved and that her husband was paid as a laborer. It can be very interesting. And then you got, you know, folk like Coolidge, Owens, Elder, and so forth. So, you know, I'm reminded of Dr. Neely Fuller, you know, his iconic statement: if you don't understand white supremacy, everything else you thought you knew will only confuse you. It can be tricky at times.
No doubt. I'm like almost at you know, I consider the Rittenhouse case to be a slam dunk for you know, his you know, eventual exoneration from the get-go.
No, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. You know, I read, you know, about the criminal background of, you know, a pedophile that was killed. I don't know why these people were out there. You know, if they were actually, if they were activists, say, you know, like Bob and Dottie Zellner and Jane Stembridge. You know, the people like Kwame Ture talk about, you know, some of the white people who were, you know, joined the civil rights movement in the South. I don't know if they were that or if they were just, you know, caught up in the dynamics of the moment, because we certainly are not seeing that that activity sustained. You know, it was a flash in the pan after the public lynching of George Floyd. You know, the protests that erupted after that were majority white, and you could tell that they were white because they were able to attack police stations without being killed. You can imagine. We know what would have happened. If it had been us attacking police stations, burning police stations, and nobody getting killed. So, but where are those activists now? Now, in every situation, there will be people radicalized, you know, like David Gilbert and Marilyn Buck and some others. You know, there will be people who will be radicalized in the process. But in terms of, you know, the pandemic was taking place, people weren't working. It was almost like a fad. It was pop culture. So with these people who are out there, you know, I don't know enough about them, their backgrounds or whatever. So I can't place them in the category of, you know, Viola Liuzzo or, you know, or Mickey Schwerner.
Mm-hmm. So
I can't do that, but what we do know is that the police accepted these armed security people to theoretically protect the property of businesses, you know, in that city, because, you know, there were protests about the police shooting of Jacob Blake. So that's why this guy left his home in Illinois and traveled armed with a weapon purchased, I think, by his mother to Wisconsin, because, you know, here's the interesting thing. I think about this a lot of times when, you know, we see these Neanderthals going berserk.
Mm-hmm.
And pointing, you know, all of their anger, you know, all of their vitriol towards people of African descent. We're not capitalists. We are not the ones who created the conditions that has caused, you know, an epidemic of opioid addiction and, you know, suicides. We didn't own any factories. We didn't move jobs out of the United States to China, who now they're claiming to be so upset about, or to Mexico, Latin America, or to the low cost geographies in Europe, like, you know, Romania and Albania and Hungary. We didn't do that. You know, we weren't responsible for you know what, you know, the things that Chris Hedges have pointed out in his, you know, America's farewell tour, the Rust Belt. We didn't create the Rust Belt. As a matter of fact, black men in the 50 largest urban centers in the United States suffered the most as a result of the erosion of the U.S. blue collar manufacturing base, steel mills and tire factories and all of the other, you know, mills jobs that were paying far more than these people working down here in these textile mills, you know, in North Carolina and in Georgia and places like that. We were dislocated and displaced in far greater numbers. All you have to do is look at statistics in a city like Detroit, where in 1970, over 70% of the black males were employed between the ages of 16 and 64. Some of those jobs, especially for the younger people, were part-time jobs, but they were employed. And I'm reminded of the priest out in LA who said, nothing stops a bullet, nothing stops a gun like a job. So 16-year-olds were working. And by 2010, so you got over 7 out of 10 black males working in Detroit, in Chicago, in Milwaukee in 1970. And by 2010, it's barely over 4 out of 10. So we suffered more. But because these people had this perception that, okay, I'm in the middle class, I got a chance to move up, you know, I'm living well, and all of a sudden they pull the rug from under them by transferring these jobs outside of the United States. Now, who transferred the jobs? The oligarchs on Wall Street. Why aren't you marching on Wall Street? Why are you looking at me like, you know, I'm in a grocery store, you know, buying, something to eat. And you're looking at me like, you know, I'm the reason why you don't have a job, because your job is in China, in Taiwan or Malaysia or Indonesia somewhere. So, you know, this is how the mass-based philosophy of white supremacy has worked, and it's worked exactly the way the racial capitalists wanted it to work, and that is, they wanted to keep the working class divided. But these people their minds are so distorted and twisted, and they've been so inculcated with the mass-based philosophy of white supremacy, that when they see a person of African descent, oh, you are my problem. Rather than the Wall Street oligarchs and their managers, the politicians manage the empire for the oligarchs. Okay? So, you know, that's where your iron needs to be focused, and not, you know, to get, you know, Donald Trump back, you know, to say the election was stolen, but because these people are responsible for whatever it is that's bothering you. These are the people who have created the problem. This is why you have a rust belt. You know, this is why when you ride through, you know, Gastonia, North Carolina, and Lincolnton, North Carolina, and Cherryville, North Carolina, why you don't see any industry. Okay, but that's, you know that's how, you know, that's how the game has been run, and they bought into it hook, line, and sinker.
Yes, sir.
They're stupid,
ignorant, and dumb. Hey, bro, I mean, you know, and it's pointless to. I do it for sports sometime when I can tell the gentleman is not armed at McDonald's sitting around in some of these dilapidated areas like Cherryville and South Gastonia. It's pointless to try to argue them into reality. You know, clearly, you know, race has allowed politicians to exploit their emotions for the political gain of the politician at the expense of the displaced worker. And in too many instances, the white person, there's only one conclusion you can come to, brother. The racism and white supremacy, it is a mental illness.
Dr. Wilson said it,
man, the number one mental illness.
And
with the background that you gave, you know, it's been a historical problem. We have not evolved that much. You know, economically harassed whites will attack blacks, period.
Well, and see, and that was the point. Go ahead, bro.
I think it's all the game orchestrated by the Zionists. And I think black people suffer from the same problem. We point the finger at white supremacy. We think that we think about, you know, the Ku Klux Klan member in the Klan hat, or the old, you know, hillbilly redneck, you know, with the straw hat.
Right.
But in reality, these people are not the people that are the brains behind the operation.
No.
It's one thing that Malcolm pointed out, you know, that the white liberal, which, you know, his time, he probably wanted to say the white small hat is the worst enemy to at his time what he called the Negro, because he said that the, you know, the conservative is the wolf, and the wolf, you can see the wolf coming from a mile away. You know what the wolf is going to do, but the fox is the animal that will trick you. The fox is the animal that will hide. And it's a system in place that is created. You know, even we talk about the Wall Street oligarchs, you know, the majority of those are who?
People like Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs. That's the name that keeps coming up. There's a culpability with the Blankfeins of the world, but the ignorant redneck, you know, they are dual oppressors with the Wall Street oligarchs, as McAroo alluded to. They have always been used, to quote Chris Hedges, as the shock troops to destroy progressive movements.
I don't think that they've ever possessed the intellectual capacity.
That's ignorant, stupid, and dumb, brother.
To orchestrate any type of global control over black people. When I think about white supremacy in its foundation, I think that the original definition, when somebody says that they are the chosen people of God, and that everybody else under them is supposed to serve them, that's the definition of somebody thinking that they're supreme over everybody else. If you look in history, you don't have this thought process until Judaism. Prior to that, where do you have white supremacy? You look at the Greeks and the Romans, they didn't say they were supreme over black people. In fact, in many of their accounts, they praised black people and looked up to black people in most regards better than themselves. And that when they compared them to Europe and other, you know, European nations. So you first start to get the denigration of the African or the black man from Judaism, going back to the Hermetic myth. And then you get the Babylonian Talmud, which which then further expands on that denigration of the black man. And then you get the papal bulls in Christianity looking down on people. But where was this idea created? It was created by the same people who consider themselves supreme to everybody else. The same people who are the brainchild behind what we call white supremacy now. And the reason why we can never defeat it is because we're often distracted in battling with these people who consider to be these rednecks who are the quote unquote vanguards of white supremacy that are put out on the front line, so to speak, like the pawns to fight against us and keep us constantly at each other so that these other people can continue to rule everybody.
Yeah, but you know, it's not it is a distraction, because you know, people can't distinguish between the different levels of white supremacy. You know, that's why I created the term the raw elements of the white supremacy dynamic. But you know, these are people who we can't simply ignore, because the raw elements of the white supremacy dynamic are the first line of defense for the oligarchs. Now, even though, like Rittenhouse, they out protecting property.
What a joke.
Yeah, the very property that they're protecting, an oligarch, let's say they're protecting a factory. The oligarch could shut the factory down and move the job to Taiwan tomorrow. What are you protecting? Okay. But because white supremacy has created what Dr. Bobby Wright called these psychopathic racial personalities, and they operate at different levels, at the very sophisticated level, at political levels and whatever. And a lot of times, because, we don't engage in critical thinking and look at things holistically, it's like Malcolm said, when you start talking about the part of the piece, worry about the whole. Okay. So you can't just get hung up on, the people, the mass murderers or whatever, the people like the Dylan Roos and Byron Dealer Beckwiths, and Edgar Ray Preacher killing, and the murderers of James Earl Cheney and Mickey Schwerin and Andrew Goodman. But these people are real in terms of their threat. Mm-hmm. So you have to be aware of that, but you have to also understand that new Jim Crow Joe Biden is part of that same process. But oftentimes, or Barack Obama, the Negro imperialist, using the vernacular of the great revolutionary Fred Hampton. So, see, that's where you have to have African-centered critical thinking in order to understand that if we're talking about the whole, it's holistic. As Malcolm said, worry about the whole. At a given moment, if the Ku Klux Klan, I remember Cleve Sellers telling me this story. We talked a little bit about it yesterday when we were on with Dr. Akinyele Omojo, the author of We Will Shoot Back. Cleve was in the headquarters. He was in the SNCC headquarters in Atlanta, and he was on the phone with Ralph Featherstone, a courageous brother, who was killed driving a car that blew up. They were trying to kill Jameel El-Amin, H-Rap Brown, and they killed Ralph Featherstone and William Shea Payne in 1970. But Ralph was a courageous brother. So he's in the Mississippi Delta. Not sure if he was in Greenwood, Cleveland, Greenville, exactly where he was. But he told Cleve that the Ku Klux Klan Knight Riders were riding by shooting in the house that they were in. And Cleve asked him, say, well, what are you doing? He said, I'm shooting back. So when you're being attacked, okay, even though the strings may be, the puppeteer may be way up here, right? So like the Wiz, right? I mean, the puppeteer may be way up here, but right now this guy is right in front of me. I gotta deal with him to survive in order to organize. And
I don't think it's a problem with that. The only problem I have is when we align ourselves with the puppeteer.
Oh yeah.
That's the only problem I have.
Yeah. That,
we can't see past the, I see so many Negroes, align themselves with, the liberal and the Democratic Party, and also their various networks, whether that be, or their outlets, whether that be CNN or any other, media hat on organization. And then you look historically, when you see the formulation of the NAACP and you see the hat involvement in that, there's an alignment there where we can't, it's almost like Neely Fuller made a statement when he said that if you don't understand white supremacy, everything else that you think you know won't only confuse you.
Right.
Yeah. And
where there was somebody in, I can't remember the brother's name, who made this statement, but he said, if you don't understand Zionism and everything else you think you understand about white supremacy, we're on the confusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're kind of one and the same. And, you know, I will draw attention to the godless Russians and their oppression of Muslims. We're talking about a global system. You know, the war is being waged on at every front by everybody. You know, I think the guy who capitalized it the best was John Henry Clark. We don't have any friends out here. Mm-hmm. You know, you got Muslims who oppress indigenous Africans. You got Russians who oppress Muslims and use blacks as imperialist expendables. Mm-hmm. You know, and they don't believe in nothing, the godless Russians. See? So, obviously, you know, I mean, to your point, though, the NAACP, formed by the capitalist class, because so many blacks were aligning themselves in the socialist camp. You know, so that has been our historical role to be used as cannon fodder, or to, you know, enhance the ranks of these people who have individual agendas, to the negation of the black agenda. But the question becomes, what is the black agenda? What is the black ideology? What is our foreign affairs philosophy? What do we have, a domestic affairs philosophy? You know, and if we are to align ourselves, you know, that would aid and abet our ability to, you know, join these organizations from a position of strength as opposed to weakness. You know, ideology is critical. You know,
I think the best domestic philosophy that we had came from Booker T.
Okay.
And I think the best foreign philosophy we had came from Garvey. I think that if we revisit both of those, then we have the answers that we need to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, I think, is Elijah's idea of separatism.
Assuming he was serious. Malcolm said he wasn't even serious. But go ahead.
his idea of separatism was also, you know, a good idea. But I just don't think, when you realistically speaking, you know, having a separate nation within a nation, to me, is not viable, because you're only putting yourself in a position to be controlled if you don't have the power to really enforce that separatism.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that they brought up yesterday was that, and they were talking about, you know, Booker T. Washington, and it is interesting, and it's not you know, inconsequential that Washington and Garvey were attacked by the same ideological mindset of people of African descent, or Negroes, whatever you want to call them.
Interesting.
That's no accident. But one of the things that they mentioned yesterday, one of the professors, might have been Umoja, I can't remember which one, was that, you know, this, see, we have to be careful about labeling people. We have to be really, 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 you know, we have to be meticulous and nuanced. You know, this Washington has worn the label of accommodationist, right? Without people understanding the nuances of his politics and what he was dealing with in Macon County, Alabama in 1883, as Reconstruction was being systematically dismantled and overthrown. I said 1881, in the 1880s, okay? The professor said that white people in Alabama, which, you know, was already like becoming like, you know, the black belt, you know, those counties that stretch from Macon County over past Greene and Perry, Dallas County, where Selma's located, they viewed what Booker T. Washington was doing was an attempt to establish a nation within a nation.
Mm.
Now, we're talking here about both the raw elements of the white supremacy dynamic of the post-Reconstruction South and, you know, their political managers and whatever oligarchs were supporting them, right? It's like, you know, Birmingham becoming, you know, a center for, you know, steel production. So they viewed Washington, they viewed Tuskegee Institute as a threat. And as a matter of fact, they mentioned this historical incident that took place. They decided Washington had passed and Robert Russell Moulton was the president. And they decided that with Washington out the way, that they were going to march on Tuskegee and destroy the school.
And now, and look at the people who were the primary donors to Washington.
Henry Ford.
Most of them were the Anglo-Saxons. Most of the whites who were against him were who? The Hats.
Yeah. And so what happened was, Moulton found out that this attack was imminent.
Mm.
So they had a ROTC a major there, or class or whatever. And they had arms. So he called out all of the ROTC people and any other people that were there, and almost everybody that came from the South knew how to use a shotgun and a rifle. Mm. Okay, that was just, it was basic for hunting, but also for protection. So the students, Moulton armed the students, and they took up positions to protect the university. And when the white supremacists realized that was happening, they backed off. So, you know, so when we make these statements, you know, like we've heard this, Booger T versus WB. We have to be holistic in our analysis, you know, to understand. But you know, to almost his point, there is no African liberation in any individual country or locale. Not in the truest sense of the word. You know, you could possibly have, you know, strong, you know, countries in the Caribbean if they, you know, organized and unified. And you may have a strong outpost here or there on the African continent. But as we see what's happening with Ethiopia, we see what happens when African people attempt to practice Kujichakalia self-determination. But I am hopeful because of the number of things that I see African youth beginning to do, particularly in West Africa. And you know, I posted this thing about this protest against the French in Burkina Faso. Now, the youth have been rallying in Mali now for over a year, telling France, get the hell out. We're through with you. You're not wanted here. Okay. And so, you know, last week in Burkina Faso, there was a jihadist attack that killed 53 police officers. They attacked this post. I don't know why their security wasn't better prepared for it, but anyway. So this caused massive demonstrations against the current government of the country. And so France decided that they were going to send a convoy of troops from, I think they were in Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire. And they needed to get through Burkina Faso to get to Niger. And the African youth when they found out they were coming, they blocked the road and stopped them in their tracks. You're not coming through here to carry out whatever kind of mission you're carrying out. And they demanded to say, we want to see what's in the trucks. Because we believe you're giving weapons to the terrorists. Now, these are African youth operating in the spirit of the great Thomas Sankara. And this is one thing that, you know, that gives me hopes. Gives me hope that I really do believe that African youth are going to overthrow neocolonialism, and that they are going to lead the reclamation and restoration of African people. I may be wrong. You know, I just don't want to look at just a few isolated events. We know that Obama and other, Biden just announced he's going to have an African leadership conference. That would be a conference of neocolonialists, because, you know, they can see this happening.
Right now, he Biden is facing immense pressure from the citizens of Ethiopia. They are rejecting the U.S.'s attempt to overthrow and invade Ethiopia. And I think your assessment is warranted and it is correct. You know, eventually the youth are going to grow tired of the traditional way of corruption on the continent, and they're going to be tired of being exploited. And with the open access to vast amounts of information from all around the globe, being able to connect with other Africans in the diaspora, and these revolutionary and liberation ideas flowing into the minds of younger people, they're only going to grow up with the idea of doing something to improve their country. So, like you said, it's only going to be a matter of time. And you invoke the spirit of Thomas Sankara, who was the president of that country. It's why it's very important for us not to overlook every contribution that Africans make, because no matter how big or small you may think your contribution is, once your contribution goes down in history, future generations can reference what you did. And even though you may not win the war, you know, you may contribute to the ultimate victory. So a lot of people right now, they're afraid to strike a blow against white supremacy or against other people, Arabs, Asians, or whoever, for African liberation. But you have to remember that if you just lay a brick on that foundation, originally somebody else will continue your work if you fall short until the house is built.
Exactly.
And that's the mindset that we have to push forward with. And what's happening in Burkina Faso right now is probably what you're going to continue to see across the continent. I mean, we got, you know, things happening in Guinea. You know, of course, we know about the situation in Ethiopia. So, you know, there's a lot of positive outlook that we can point to. And this is where we have to, you know, roll up our sleeves and get our hands dirty and see what we can contribute.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, if they're inspired about, you know, Thomas Sankara, you know, Amilcar Cabral, Kwame Nkrumah, Patrice Lumumba, and others, you know, Winnie Mandela, Bantu Biko, Chris Hani, how inspired would they be if they knew about Narmer? Because to me, Narmer is the seminal African nationalist, the seminal unifier of African people, the person who was able to convince African people to submerge their ethnic identities and become one people. That, to me, that is the model. And it has to be all African as opposed to everyone who's on the African continent, continentalism. It has to be all African. Okay. So, you know, that's to me, that's, you know, that's our job, to make people aware of these models to emulate. Okay. You know, the great Omawale Malcolm X, Marcus Mosiah and his two Amys, Ashwoods and Jocks, the great Fannie Lou Hamer, Ida Wells Barnett, Assata Shakur, Yaa Santiwa, right? Amanda Arenas. I mean, come on. You know, the models are there. And that's why these people are so desperate to hang on to this white race theory form of education. Because they know, you know, just like Jefferson knew, right? Mm-hmm. That's why he banned the ruins of empires, right?
I mean, that's why we have to elevate that totality of African history across the continent, because in traveling to various countries, I'll tell you from experience, many Africans across the continent in some cases are not even aware of these war heroes from countries that are right there, neighboring their country.
Don't even know about it.
You know, I've been in Uganda and people don't know who Dedan Kamakut is. That's a travesty. You talking about somebody who was the staple of the fight against colonialism and helping to strike fear into the hearts of Europeans to relinquish their control over these countries.
Right.
We talked about holistic development as a basis for aiding and abetting this change in consciousness. You know, it's obvious that Wilson, you know, talked about the African collective being a socially created group. You know, he raised the question, you know, the European has the vital things in life, or have control of the vital things in life, water, jobs, what to wear, when you go to work, how to speak. You got to do this, that, and the other to get paid. You know, do this, you don't get the trinkets. To be rewarded and punished by that people is to be created by that people. Of course, you're always going to have Amoses and Macaroos. But for the collective, you know, it's a travesty. It's, you know, it's mass no difficulty, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's ultimately, you know, freedom is not secure without a firm economic foundation. I think that's the direction in which Booker T was going. You know, drop your buckets where you are, the firm economic foundation, one of the tenets and one of the components of Washingtonism. Vis-a-vis Du Bois, who was more concerned with a different type of direction, I think.
Well, you know, that's why, you know, I always say, you know, we have to be synthesizers. I mean, you know, I got this from reading, you know, Dr. Richard King, The African Origin of Biological Psychiatry. You know, he said synthesis is the key to ascension. Now he was really talking about the synthesis between a saw, a set, and their product, Heru. But I took it and applied it to, you know, Douglas
Oh, yeah.
Delaney, right? Washington and Du Bois and Garvey, you know, to Martin and Malcolm, to us and the Black Panther Party.
Yeah.
To others.
Concept has broad applicability, but yeah.
Yeah, but you know, so we do have to we do have to extol the virtues and teach. I know Amos was talking about his when he went to a school in Ghana,
mm-hmm.
and he was asking the students some questions, and
uh-uh.
they were talking about, you know, their history, you know, originating with, you know, Prince Henry the Navigator or something to that. I can't remember exactly how you put it almost.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's, you know, rather than, you know, Sundiata Kieta, right? You know, or Mansa Musa, you know, right? So that's, or, you know, even for people from their own country. I mean, you know, so not territory would be more applicable than country, because
mm-hmm.
you know, this is you know, the Berlin Conference started meeting on November 15th, 1884. So, you know, this is the month, November, where, you know, these Europeans, you know, were sitting in Berlin. And their objective was to keep each other, you know, from fighting each other over territory, because they know the history. Europe history is a history of repeated and rampant wars. You can't even name the 100 Years' War, the 7 Years' War. I mean, just one war after another, right? I mean, going back to the Greeks or whatever. And so they say, we got to figure out a way, because we know what's going to happen. The French are going to start fighting the British, right? The Portuguese are going to start fighting the Germans. We know what's going to start happening. So let's carve this place up. Let's carve it up. And the mess that we have in Africa today is a product of that.
Mm-hmm.
But Africans, the leader, particularly the neocolonial leaders, they hold on to these neocolonial boundaries as if they created them. It's you know, the French, the Italians, and the British had parts, you know, of Somalia. Right? I mean, so... I mean, that would be a good starting point. And Kwame Nkrumah, Ahmed Sekou-Touré, and Modibo Keita of Mali started this process when they formed the Ghana-Guinea-Mali Union. Okay? And Nkrumah and Keita were overthrown, and they had almost as many assassination attempts on the life of Sekou-Touré as they had on Fidel Castro.
Wow.
That's why Sekou-Touré formed a people's militia. And when the Portuguese got up the nerve to invade Guinea in 1970, they ran them back into the sea. And then and for the African traitors who would collaborate with the Portuguese, they hung their bodies from bridges.
But that's why I think it was smart for Abiy Ahmed to invoke the citizens of Ethiopia to take up arms against the Tigray rebels.
Exactly.
Because not only does that help them fight against the rebels, but anybody else who tries to invade and overthrow or have some type of coup against the government, now you have to deal with armed citizens that are ready to fight.
Yeah, and it's so obvious that In many people, not just in Ethiopia, but in other parts of Africa, can clearly see that there's no balance here, because why are there no sanctions on the TPLF?
Because they're funded by the U.S.
You know, they were talking about, you know, the thing they go, what, you know, we have a grave humanitarian crisis in Tigray. How do you have so many weapons and no food? They said, well, Ethiopia blocked the food trucks and Garrison, a white radical female from out on the West Coast, does a lot of work study on Africa. She was one of the first people who pointed out along with I think Brother Baraka also. Ethiopia was letting the food trucks go through, and then the food trucks weren't coming back.
Mm.
What was in the food trucks? Weapons.
And a lot of it's probably coming from Egypt too.
Sudan
and Egypt.
Yeah, Sudan particularly because of the border. In fact, there was an attack on the GERD, you know, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, and it came from Sudan. I don't know if I sent that to you or not. If I didn't, I need to send it to you. Yeah, there was an attack, and the attack came from Sudan. Okay, and so, man,
and well, a lot of times, you know, Egypt has been doing too is they've been brokering power deals with other African countries. I know they just signed a deal with Malawi, sending power to Malawi from their hydro dam in an effort to try to galvanize as much support as they can against, you know, Ethiopia and their dam.
Yeah, and I can't remember what this river is now. I can't remember if it comes out of the Central Africa. I think it comes out of the DRC, I believe. Egypt is trying to get a dam built on that river in case they don't succeed in stopping, Ethiopia. But, Darren, there was something else. It skipped my mind. I had something else on my mind about that situation there. Darren, it's gone. It went out. But, oh, I know what it was. There was a report from some African sources. I don't know how true this is. But there was a report from some African sources that Blinken, the Zionist, very disappointed that Uhuru Kenyatta would not cave in, supposedly, to their demands, because Kenyatta had flown to Ethiopia and met with Abiy Ahmed before Blinken came over there. And when they asked him what they talked about, he said it was just a personal visit. But he went over there after all of this mess. The Tigray army is going to be in Addis within a matter of days. And Uhuru Kenyatta went over there to meet with, President Ahmed. And so, according to this source, the U.S. was very disappointed that Kenya didn't cave in to their demands. Now, we'll have to see, you know, how this plays out, but you know, that's what was said. So we see, look, the fact of the matter is, you know, it's Ethiopia today, just like it was Libya, you know, just like Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, Nigeria. There is a total effort to destabilize the entire continent. Mozambique, right? The DRC, the Eastern DRC has been destabilized. I mean, the group that was accused of attacking of the terrorist bombings in Kampala has been operating out of the DRC since the 1990s. Why hasn't Uganda gone in there and stopped this? I'm sure the DRC would welcome their help. Or at least I would think they would. Because the people in the Eastern DRC, in the North Kivu province and Oriente province, are the ones who are primarily being attacked by this terrorist organization, which is aligned with the Islamic State called the Allied Democratic Forces.
Hmm.
So,
yeah, I know we're running short on time.
Okay, bro.
I know it's interesting that Egypt would try to build another dam. You would think that with the amount of access to sunlight that they have, that they will opt for solar energy.
You would think.
But I'll let you go ahead and close us out, Gullah Jack.
Yeah, very briefly, I think I would say, you know, to echo Dr. Turay, is we are poorly organized people. Organization is the weapon of the oppressed. Minds, we have to coalesce, forget about individual differences, think about the collective. The African situation is worldwide in terms of these particular issues in combating a society, this society in particular, whose nature it is to hide its political agenda. Bibi Fahodiye.
Bibi Fahodiye.
Bibi Fahodiye.
Power or the lack of power. I want to repeat this. Power or the lack of power. If your education in this institution is not about gaining real power, not jobs, because your jobs do not represent power. Not getting elected, that does not represent power either. Buying your houses and fine clothes does not represent power either. If it is not about real power, you are being miseducated and misled, and you will die educated and misled. If your study of Black history is merely an exercise in feeling good about yourself, then you will die feeling good. The study of history then must be more than the pumping up of your self-esteem and the pumping up of your pride. Those things are important, but ultimately those things are not the means by which we will save ourselves as people in this world.